Hello, everybody. This is the Friendly Bear Podcast, where we interview some of the best and brightest traders in the trading community. Listen to inspiring stories and nuggets of insight from current and future game changers in the trading space. Listen and learn as we explore all types of trading niches with some of the best in the industry from a Friendly Bear point of view. Make sure to check out the Friendly Bear Podcast's new YouTube channel called Friendly Bear Research, which includes all the podcast video content and supplemental screen shares. If you enjoy the podcast, please consider leaving a 5-star review on iTunes. With that being said, I'm your host, David, aka Reverse Long, and this is the Friendly Bear Podcast. Let's dive in. What's up, everyone? This is David, aka Reverse Long, and I'm over here with Jerry Campbell and my friend Alec Farwell. I reached out to the story about this podcast. I reached out to Alec. I've known Alec for a long time. Man, it's been like over 10 years now. It's been a long time. And we've done a few podcasts together when the podcast was brand new. And, Alec was actually educating me, as crazy as it sounds. He was educating me on crypto because I knew nothing about crypto. I was just a stubborn bear as it gets, saying, oh, crypto's a whole scam. It's a pump and dump, this and that. And, the podcast is crazy. I use the podcast to like educate myself about a lot of different topics, especially crypto. And looking back now, like I opened up January 1st in El Salvador. I've get in contact. I'm going to Dubai in a week and a half for a BSV conference where Dr. Craig Rice, Satoshi Nakamoto is going to be. In Puerto Rico, I've gotten in contact with the crypto community there. So I've really come a long way. And it all started from those first few podcasts with Alec about that. The super bear, perma bear crypto, as bear as it gets. I would roll my eyes, anything crypto related. And now like I think I'm level headed now. I've gone to the middle, you know. And speaking about all that. So this podcast, we have all the whole Elon saga playing out with Twitter. And I reached out to Alec to see what he thought about it. And he's like, oh, I've actually been discussing it with my friend Jerry Campbell, and he actually has a unique background. So I was like, oh, you know, let's make a podcast about it. You know, this is what the podcast is for. I created this podcast to bring my friends along the ride, you know, and share. We have all these cool conversations. So now I'm going to put it out there and take it further. So yeah, Alec, you want to give a background about Jerry and how, and Jerry, you want to describe your background? You were talking off the podcast. You have such a unique background, man. It's incredible. Talking about TweetDeck. I use TweetDeck every day nice. To short sell Chinese stocks. So, you know, but yeah. Okay, Alec. Yeah. You want to take it?
I love Jerry because so I'm launching History Token, which is a decentralized fact checking oracle, essentially. So we're using it to take on the media and research and all that kind of stuff and give information, you know, a real shake out in the world. I was fascinated with Jerry because of his prior experience, primarily at Thomson Reuters. He was the president and head of global technology, which my understanding, that's one of the largest media companies in the world. And he was also CTO of Beachbody On Demand, which I think is the best-selling fitness program ever. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that was incredible. Yeah, and tell us about your TweetDeck stuff because I didn't even know that. I just found out about it.
Yeah. So thanks for inviting me on. It's great. Great to meet you. This is a great topic. I think first of all, let me talk about History Token. I've been in media forever. I'll talk about that in a second. But the History Token piece of it, to me, I think the world needs an objective source of information. I actually studied a heck of a lot of journalism in college way back when, and was pounded on the journalistic ethic, right? Which is freedom from bias and things like that. And I think the world that we live in right now is a little bit different from that, right? We could all have our criticisms, and I've certainly got mine. I did spend a few years inside AOL, which was part of Time Warner, so I was close to that side of things as well. And then I went to Reuters and ran technology globally for Reuters, which was news and all the company fundamentals and all of that. And the thing that I saw in those two experiences, and I'll tie it back to History Token, is that a lot of decisions go into what news is published and the angle and the perspective, and there are many, many layers. And I think where we are right now, those layers are impacting the quality of the information that we get. And I'm not just talking about breaking news. I'm just talking about information that we get in the world about what's really happening. And so I'm fired up about Alec's approach to trying to create a way to normalize and give people a say in the information. So, and then 2 seconds, I mean, I've been in the internet since before it was cool. I was at CompuServe forever ago. I was at Alta Vista. After that, I was at Compaq in the middle. Interesting note, talking about Elon. When I was at Compaq, we spun out Alta Vista as its own company. I was on the team of people that did that. It was right around 2008 or so. And we acquired two companies. One was shopping.com and the other was a little company called Zip2 that did local information. And that was Elon and Kimball, his brother's first company. And that was, if you've seen the picture of him with the McLaren out in front of the street and he's smiling, that was because of that deal. So I had the chance to briefly meet him back then and knew he was an individual for sure. Super intense. And then a little bit also that ties in here is as an angel investor, I was a full-time angel investor after I left Reuters in about 2008 or so, and jumped right into what I believed was the future, which is social media at the time. And if you back up to 2008, 2009, there was just so much cool stuff going on. And I believe that the ability for open platforms to connect people, super, super powerful. So as an angel investor, I got into a company that was started by some really close friends of mine called Surmise, and then was also in the seed of TweetDeck. And both of those companies, right around 2009, 2010, were acquired by Twitter. So because of my connections in there, I was very close to Twitter as they did their Series C and beyond that. And a little one of those, you know, it's either a good moment or a bad moment, but certainly a moment in time. I had left Reuters a few months before, was angel investing, and was deeply involved in Twitter at the time, helping to lay out the plans to grow the company. Just being involved in the group of guys. There was just a lot of great people around the company. And Jack Dorsey called me and asked if I was interested in being chief revenue officer. And I declined. I declined because I didn't believe that they were committed to building it into a business. And that was over 10 years ago. And I think we still see the remnants of that. So I'm really excited about where it looks like Elon could potentially take it. I've got a lot of thoughts on that. But anyways, I've talked too much. That's about me.
Yeah, I think it's interesting how you said, like, you know, they weren't, you thought at first they weren't serious about making money. Is that, and, yeah,
flat out.
And that's been their problems, like, for how long now? You know, and from what I understand, my limited knowledge of it, because I mostly trade the small caps. I kind of have the larger caps in the back of my head, and I'm being aware. And I have a longer term position on Twitter, because, like, I see potential. I mean, I use it every day. I use TweetDeck. I have a Twitter profile. I go through like all the major players in the small caps trading and try to see what I should short. I get ideas from Twitter. But like, you know, to see Twitter get beaten down over time and have these issues with the trolls. I see the trolls all the time, the fake robots and the trolls of the Muppets, we call them. And it needs to be cleaned up. Like the platform is nice. And it's all, but it has so many issues. And then you have the board members, from what I understand, they have no skin in the game. They don't have, like, they're not invested in the company financially, you know? That's what I heard out of a podcast with Shamath and a couple others. They were talking about the board members when Elon was about to acquire it. And, so I'm getting that from that podcast. I didn't really look into it. I'm just, this is my limited knowledge of it. And, you know, it's just like, I mean, it shows, it's like the stock price has been beaten down so much. You have this platform, it's really hard. They have like recently they have all these features, Twitter Spaces, Twitter Blue. The platform is cool. Everybody's using it, but then they love to ban people. That, you know, they have all these trolls, these bots. It just needs to be cleaned up. So to have like Elon try to acquire it or in the process of acquiring it, that's like a godsend, I think, you know. So, you know, yeah. So any more thoughts on that?
Alec, do you have any thoughts? I got thoughts about everything.
I think that your thoughts would be more interesting right now. So,
all right, I'm happy to share. So all the way back, the very beginning, Twitter had a problem with bots, and there were a couple different purposes of bots. At one point, they were just machines sending messages, and Twitter was used as kind of a general communication messaging bus between computers. And that was really messy because you'd see that. But the real issue is the slanting of the messages and the ability to kind of overwhelm the system with a certain perspective or point of view. And I think that comes from two places. One is that anybody can sign up and anybody can tweet. One of the things that I like that Elon has said is that he's interested in actually tying it to people so that there's some understanding of who the people are behind it. There's kind of a social responsibility that comes with being able to put a message out to anybody in the world. And that to me seems like a fair trade-off. I haven't really thought it through too much. I know in different realms, anonymity is really, really important. If the platform turns to a place where anonymity is not a primary feature, I think we'll see things clean up there a lot. The second source, I think, of where there's concern about bias, and I'll just say concern because I'm not going to, you know, cite any specifics, but the concern about bias comes from who is choosing and what criteria they're using to choose what is appropriate and what is not appropriate. And as I've mentioned, I'm kind of old school. I started managing UGC projects, user-generated content projects, in the 90s at CompuServe. I was responsible for the personal page service. And there were some precedents set, and that's what led to Section 230. And Section 230 says that either you are a news outlet that has a perspective, or you're essentially a library that carries all kinds of books, and you're not responsible. You're just the seller of the books. So it was tied to, if I understand all my history right, it was tied to an old case way, way before the internet. So Section 230 says in the United States that if you are intervening to shape the editorial content, you are a publisher and then have certain responsibilities. And those responsibilities come down to liability, the ability to be sued, and all kinds of different things. And the way historically all of the technology platforms have handled Section 230 is that they don't intervene with any type of perspective. So what we've seen with Twitter and with other platforms is that they've blurred that line for probably good reason, which is, what about hate speech? What about clearly misleading information? There are things that don't violate the law, which is what Section 230 would cover, that clearly cause the platform to have issues. Elon has said, one of the best quotes I like is, you know, if it's legal, it'll be on there. If it's illegal, it will not be on there. And that to me, I'm just interpreting it. But what he's saying is we're going to return back to Section 230. And what I like about that is censorship is really, really important, especially on these platforms that have such reach. And so when a law is put in place to protect certain people that are very obviously challenged for some type of situation, that's considered, it's legislated, it's voted on, and it's handled in such a way that represents the people. When there's a perspective that is within an editorial team, and that editorial team has a certain persona to it or perspective to it, and that's not challenged by public opinion, or that's not challenged by the people who have a stake in where that platform reaches, I think we end up in a dangerous situation. So my bottom line to that is, what I expect is that we're going to go from a world where there is definitely some type of, you could call it censorship, you could call it community moderation, you could call it anything you want, but to move away from an active hand in that, to move closer to the law. And what that does is that puts pressure back on the system within the United States to decide what is and is not within the law. And to me, that's the appropriate place to address censorship. So, wow, I said a lot there.
No, interesting. Well, we needed to hear that. You know, I didn't understand the whole rule about censorship, or like what constitutes censorship, or is it, you know, what does it fall under? What, you know, so it's interesting to hear that. Yeah. How about you, Alec? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah. I'm just wondering if Biden's Ministry of Truth is going to be the one that's determining what gets censored. You know what I mean? Cause not to get all weird, but I don't really trust them to be determining what fact is. And yeah, if that sets any barometer at all of what's legal to have on the platform because it's misinformation, then I think we have a major problem there.
It's interesting that it came up 2 days or 3 days after the bid was accepted to, you know, it was clearly a response to the acquisition of Twitter, clearly a response, which makes me think they previously had control and they're worried about losing control. But
yeah. So I think, you know, like I mentioned before the podcast, we got to be, I like my podcast. I don't want to get deleted or whatever, but you know, I put a lot of work into it, man. It'd be a shame, but, what was I about to say? The Biden's laptop, the son's laptop. I think I can mention that. I'm stepping in territory over here. I gotta be careful. But like, you know, I thought it was pretty important information when that came out. I was like, oh man, this is good. New York Post put, you know, this is good info. Now this is, the world's gonna know about this. And guess what happened? It's got shoved to the side. It's hearsay, whatever. So like, you know, and that's a lot of these platforms. They're controlled by a certain group with an agenda, and they want to hide certain things like that. So like, that's the thing. Like I saw Elon as like someone that's I don't know. Is he in the middle? Is he right? Is he left? Is he in the middle? Is he going to have like, there should be like a fair ground where everyone can like choose to figure out what's their own opinions or their own, you know, whatever they think about something. I'm just trying to remain, you know, YouTube friendly over here, but treading lightly. But yeah, so you know, it's like okay, so when is that going to stop? When is that like okay? Elon tries to do something, and then they clearly attack. I know, like with trading, when I don't think anything's a coincidence. I'm one of these guys that trades based off of like theories and stuff. You know, I make up an imagination of what the CEO is thinking, what this is thinking, because I don't know. I'm not there. I'm coming up with ideas and I'm trading around that. So like to hear that's what the Ministry of Truth, is that what it's called? Came up with that. Is that what it's called?
That's the sarcastic name for it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. So then they came up with that right after. It's like, okay, so are they just going to keep counterattacking this way? Like, and then we can just never trust any of this stuff, any of this stuff out there, you know, because that's a problem.
Yeah, I think you got to go back to understand why things are as they are right now. We definitely have bias in the media. I use a thing called adfontesmedia.com. I think it's ADFONTES, and they do a very like scientific study. It's awesome, and they kind of plot how reliable and how politically centered or not centered every media outlet is. And I think, you know, I watch that pretty carefully because I'm very interested. Things, you know, different news outlets move over time, and it's fascinating. There's a fundamental mismatch in the way news is happening right now, which is, okay, so I was inside Time Warner. I ran search at AOL from, you know, in the early 2000s. And so I was there as an executive and got to have kind of a front row seat to how Time Warner worked. And that was a little bit of view into CNN. And then also had my own pressures because we had lots of users and there was a pressure to do certain things in our search results. And here's the issue. Traditionally in publishing, you can go back to early newspapers, you can go to magazines, you can go to television. You've got advertisers, which are paying for the media. They're paying for presence to be promoted, and they tend to drive a lot of things. And then you've got the editorial, which may actually go against that. That problem has never been solved. So when you look at why is our media currently biased, well, you know, the cynic in me, but I think it's being realistic. There's only two things that matter when you look at news. What about the money and what about the power, right? And so our system is currently set up. You know, all the way back to the early days, there was this tension between the money people and the editorial people. We as a society never resolved that. And I think we're all responsible for it because open media is and news is what's considered the fourth branch of the government. It's what keeps everything honest and keeps the transparency. We've lost a little bit of that because of the advent of blogging, where it's cheaper to have lower quality bloggers, but have them everywhere. And so the news quality goes down. It's more profitable to do clickbait rather than real news stories. Real news stories take a lot of work. right? And if a clickbait story gets makes more money, it's very tough to justify that. So the dollars and the power really do drive a lot of things. This is you know, why I'm so fired up about anything that's community driven, because when I was in undergraduate, I studied communication, and then I went to business school after that. When I was an undergraduate, I studied mass media, and we were given a recipe for specifically how to get attention in news. I had a news class, and it was how inflammatory is it? How personally relevant is it? There's like, it's basically what tricks you, kicks off your amygdala, right? Turns you into a rage monster, right? And when it was the, you know, the 80s, and we were talking about, you know, a news story about a fire or a kidnapping, those things seemed valuable and maybe even innocuous. But in the world today, where it's so possible to manipulate things, those rules, those abilities to hack people's common sense and go directly to the emotion are being overused. So I think what I'm looking at, this is actually why I'm super fired up for History Token, is that we need a new system that doesn't have the inherent battle between the money and the objectivity. Those two things need to work in concert, and that's the promise of the blockchain. I started an idea just over a year and a half ago with my background in news and all of that. I thought the world needs something like this, and then I realized I'm probably not the guy to do it. I have other fish to fry. But then when I met Alec and saw what he was doing and using this idea of kind of proof of truth as being the driver, now what happens is, instead of these decisions that happen all outside and pressured by money and pressured by everything else, the truth is actually decided by the people who believe the truth. And the priority is decided by the people who want the news, not necessarily by the story that's being pushed. And I think those are the world that we're in, the bias that we have. We have to move the social media platforms back to something that looks like Section 230. And we've got to move our news to a situation where it's not that inherent battle between the money and the editorial. That's my personal belief.
Awesome. Yeah. Okay. And now to segue to History Token. So Alec came on the podcast last year, around this time, actually, a little bit later, and introduced History Token, the whole idea behind it. And it's pretty fascinating. You know, look around. This is perfect timing to talk about it. You know, it's with this whole Twitter saga happening and everything, all the problems with Twitter. And we have the blockchain, which can provide a solution, from what I understand, to like what's real and what's not, but and driven socially. So it's like the people are validating this through, you know, reputation. I don't know, Alec, you want to explain how that all ties in?
Yeah, so I mean, the bird's eye view of this is that blockchain is the first time in history where everyone's goals are totally aligned. So in the typical business model, so you take like Twitter, for example, you have shareholders, and then you have users of the platform, and then you have advertisers on the platform, and they all have completely different opposing things that they want to happen. So you have their advertisers that just want to reach as many people as possible. They want to pay as little as they can to do so, and they want to sell their products. You have users who just want to use the platform for free. They probably don't want to buy anything. If they do, they just want to make sure it's honest. And you have shareholders that just want to spend as little as they can on the product. They want to drive the share price up and all this kind of stuff. Blockchain, in essence, is the first time where everyone's values are totally aligned, because in order to use the system, you have to also hold a token. So every user on the platform is also a shareholder. And then with History Token, what we've done is that if you're advertising on the platform, you also have to hold History Token. So everyone's values are completely aligned. And so the high level understanding of that is, just like Jerry was saying earlier, is that we need to figure out a way to make everything work together. And so that's what we've done and what we're working on.
I see. So what Elon's trying to do is not that, because Twitter doesn't have a blockchain. It's basically Twitter with the blockchain, and of course, and better managed.
Yeah. So History Token. So I have a very singular focus with History Token. The singular focus with History Token is to be a fact checking protocol that is very, very, very good at filtering through research and weighing the research and weighing the data and then spitting out the truth. That is the focus of History Token primarily. And I believe, so I don't see like Twitter or True Social or anything really is competition at all. I think that anyone that's going to be posting on these platforms and seeking the truth is going to just use it as a source to cite. But there is a massive social media aspect to it, but it's going to be more similar to Reddit. So, and Wikipedia. So Reddit and Wikipedia, these are long form discussions for the most part, not for the most part, especially on Reddit, but you know what I mean? It's longer form discussions about facts. So the social media aspect of History Token is going to be more in line with Reddit. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you want to give maybe a quick background on History Token, like a crash course of it, because for the people that need to refresh maybe. Because we mentioned it a few times on the podcast. But maybe like, you know, summarize it a bit, what the token involves, how you came about it.
Yeah. Yeah. So essentially the way that it works is there's two aspects to it. So the first part is to just gather as much data as possible. So there's a reward mechanism there that essentially gives people History Token and rewards them for fighting the existing narrative that's on the platform. So say we're talking about COVID, or we're talking about should Elon buy Twitter, or whatever it is, whatever facts in the media that people want to discuss. And there's like 90% of the people are mass are useless, mass don't do anything, and mass whatever. The platform is going to start rewarding people with opposing viewpoints to come onto the platform and start fighting with them, basically. And so this is all to gather as much data as possible. So it's kind of like a court case. So you have, you know, all the evidence is submitted, and then after it's all submitted, it runs it through essentially, it's called the Shelling Point model, which was coined by this economist forever ago, and then Vitalik talked about it in 2014. But essentially what it does is it selects like 1,000 people at random on the protocol. And the purpose behind this is to remove all of the biases. So basically it selects 1,000 people and it says, okay, if looking at all of the data, how do you believe that everyone else is interpreting the data? And if they all are in agreement, or if you select in agreement with the rest of the people, then you're rewarded in History Token. And if you don't, then you're penalized.
Interesting. So this solves the problem of like bots and trolls and, you know, manipulation like that, because this is actually real people getting rewarded, and it's also, there's evidence of it in the blockchain.
Yes. Yeah. So that everything I just described doesn't directly affect the bots and stuff, but there's a separate protocol. I call it the checks and balances. So there's something called the bounty hunter system, which is essentially rewarding people for keeping the protocol honest. So everything on the blockchain is totally public. It's all immutable. It's all public. You can see everything. So say you're CNN or you're Fox or whatever, and you want to push a narrative, you can easily do so on most platforms by, you know, opening up 1,000 wallets, 1,000 accounts, upvoting, downvoting things, you know, running it through bots and all this kind of stuff. If you're on the History Token platform and you're someone that notices this, and you write code or you create a solution to solve this and prevent this abuse, then you're rewarded in the platform for doing so.
You know, when I hear this, you know, and like, I'm an outsider, right? I'm a trader short seller. Actually, I'm a short seller. I'm supposed to be like the bad guy, you know? But so when I hear this, but I still, you know, I come from a background, I was an architect before a trader, and like with architects, you always got to be level-headed and open-minded and cultured. And so I have that in me too, you know? So like I bring that to trading, even though I am a bear, full-on bear. But so when I hear this, it reminds me about like when I think about like YouTube now, like before, like a musician or a filmer or whatever had to go through like the Hollywood route and get like the producers and get attention and work his way up like that and network and things like that. Now you can just start a YouTube channel and like go about it yourself, or if you're a musician, you do SoundCloud, and it's all like you can just now. CNN really doesn't have they're doing really bad because of that. So that open format, so like this kind of seems like that, like it's like controlled by the people, you know. The people are going to have a chance, and like the CNN or whatever is going to have a problem because of what, you know, this, because the blockchain and all this stuff that can make this happen, you know?
I think that's right. There's a principle underneath this, which is as technology has advanced, the power has shifted from the people who build the technology to the communities that use it. Right. And so, you know, we've seen that in Twitter's just a great example. Twitter in its best form was just a box to stand on in the public square where you could just stand and yell. And if people wanted to listen, they could gather. And if not, they don't. I look forward to getting back to that. I think the same thing is true with news specifically, which is news is really controlled by a very limited number of people, which makes it subject to bias or even corruption. It makes it subject to what I would call an echo chamber, which is everybody thinking the same thing. It's just subject to a lot of things. But really, news powers the knowledge of our time. It powers our understanding of everything happening in the world. And that's why I might actually, you know, I drive, news and information comes together. It's news when it's produced by a journalist. It's information about our world when it's produced by the community. And to me, this information that is objective, or at least the bias can be identified and recognized. I love reading biased articles when I'm clear about the person's bias going in, because I want to learn the different perspectives, right? All of that is valuable. The biggest issue is when things are presented as truth when they're not truth. And so by giving power to the community, by the power shifting to the people who want to be the consumers of the news and seek this objectivity, or at least this transparency of bias, I think that's really powerful. So the notion that we're seeing kind of a sea change from an older, it's an old school model, pay for advertising, put the news story right next to it. The publisher balances everything. They yank a news story if an advertiser gets griped at, you know, all of that stuff. We're moving away from that to a world where the news consumer has the power because they can participate in the creation of the news. Wikipedia is the perfect example. At the very beginning, Wikipedia, it's not really true if it's in Wikipedia. We don't really know. Could be. I don't know anybody that criticizes the quality of the information in Wikipedia anymore because it is so tried and true, and the communities own it, pressure test it, and have have checks and balances to make sure that that information is true. That's where this is going.
You know, that is so interesting. You point all that out. So a few years ago, man, just like 4 years ago, when I was learning all this stuff that you see over here, I was tutoring on the side while I studied everything on my own. And I would tutor, I would help middle school, high school kids write essays, this and that, and their teachers. I saw the whole trends and college as well. And I saw, you know, they say, never list Wikipedia as a source. And Vic, you know, and even when I was in college, the same thing. And then now you look at Wikipedia, you see they've solved that problem. Now they list all the sources, everything's clickable. Wikipedia is pretty legit now, you know, and they've had Ivy League students, I think from Harvard or something, or other Ivy League schools, go in there and like clean it all up, you know, and put more information out there, constantly feeding it, really, like, so it provides a lot of value, you know, like we all use Wikipedia all the time now. And if we want to see the source, I mean, there's some little errors here and there, but for the most part, it's pretty legit, you know. And if you want to check the source, you have the whole list of sources. I mean, how many sources? You go to the scroll to the bottom, you have the book, the ISBN or whatever it is, and everything is there. It's like a library, you know, like a real encyclopedia almost. So, and to have, like, let's say History Token is going to take it a step further and have those sources on a blockchain and like have more people involved, just the masses involved, not just the Ivy League, Harvard guys back, you know, writing all the information for Wikipedia, you know. Yeah, this is an interesting time we're about to approach, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any other thoughts before we wrap it up here?
I had one about Elon that I was thinking earlier. I don't know if I should get into this, but I'm always like kind of an Elon skeptic, even though I love him. But I do think it's really interesting that he's making everything non-anonymous now. You know what I mean? So like the implications of that, I'm still trying to pull through in my head. I mean, this is the same guy that is trying to hook us up to computer chips and, you know, create the singularity. And whenever you have, so you have him come on as like this, like conservative, like, okay, free speech guy. And then everybody's going to be very much more open about what they're going to say on his platform. And then they're going to have their ID attached to what they're saying. That's a really interesting concept that I'm just trying to work through what he's going to do with all that data that's actually verified now.
I've thought this through a little bit, and there are a couple stages of transparency of identity. And one could be that the platform has verification of who you are. And it doesn't have to be like, you know, KYC to buy crypto. It doesn't have to be down to your, you know, show your license or anything, but it could be just validating email addresses that, you know, are credible or whatever. I don't know what the ideas are, but that doesn't mean that that necessarily is passed through to your username unless you choose to. Right. So there are ways that you could retain your external anonymity while still being a known entity to a company. I think that makes sense to me.
I hope he does that. That'd be great.
Right.
Well, yeah, it's interesting you point that out, because like in the past, I've been sketched out by Elon a few times. You know what I mean? So it's like at the same time, I think he's a better solution than whatever's going on now, you know? So, you know, I mean, my first couple of days in Puerto Rico, I was in this trading office there. Everybody's shorting Doge when he's on Saturday Night Live. And obviously he was pumping it all the way up there. It's like, this is the same guy running Twitter now. So we're going to run.
It's so interesting because I was exposed to his uniqueness very early on. And so I've watched him for a long time. I think, you know, he's human, and that's very different, right? These big public CEOs so often are so corporate and they're not human. And I think people make the mistake of conflating the human side of him, where he has opinions, what he does on his own Twitter account, with the way that he runs businesses. And I think that, you know, at first I was, you know, I'm with you, Alec. At first I was like, you know, I met the guy. You know, I'm not that impressed. And now I'm like, I'm really impressed. And in fact, I'm grateful for the work that he's doing for, you know, on the energy side and all of that. And his ability to run efficient organizations and his ability to actually accomplish objectives is in the stratosphere in terms of humans' effectiveness.
Yeah.
And so he can run large organizations, multiple large organizations, all at the same time, very high level of effectiveness. And so I look at the personal side, like, okay, so he got high on Joe Rogan. Like, he's human, yeah, right? And that to me is like, that's just a sign of the times that we can let go of this having to be false, having to be, you know, fill a role. I think it's so much more authentic for him to be who he is. But then we have the responsibility to look at that and go, oh, just like me, he's got different roles that he plays. And he's got, you know, I might be a complete goofball with my dog. And if somebody saw that, they'd think he's a nut job, right? Because I'm playing with my dog rolling around on the ground. But the truth is I can run a board meeting, right? And those two things are not mutually exclusive.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong. I love Elon Musk. Like, and I'm very, very, very happy that he's taking Twitter over. You know, I just like to always keep, you know, just like everybody else. I did the same thing with Donald Trump. Like, everybody lost their, you know, like, I have a lot of conservative friends and everybody loses their mind whenever I'm like, yeah, I'm like 90% sold. You know, I'm like concerned about these things. But no, overall, I love him, and I'm happy that I'm ecstatic. Is the correct word that he's taking over Twitter. Hopefully that, you know, yeah.
Awesome. Cool. So yeah, that was a good discussion. Perfect. Any other last thoughts before we close it out?
No, thanks for the opportunity to talk about this stuff.
That was great. That was great. Overall discussion about all those topics. Pretty cool. All right. Well, guys, we'll keep in touch and maybe we'll do a follow-up in the future.
All right. Thanks, Andy.
I'll see you guys later.
That concludes today's episode. Make sure to like and subscribe to the channel on the platform you use. The Friendly Bear Podcast is hosted by me, David, where you can find me on Twitter at @reverse_long. You can find the Friendly Bear Podcast at www.thefriendlybearpodcast.com, as well as on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audible, Amazon Music, and now on YouTube at Friendly Bear Research. Until next time, thank you for listening to the Friendly Bear Podcast.